At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Translator's Preface of 10 Books on Architecture. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. The 10 Books on Architecture by Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, translated by Maurice Hickey Morgan. Translator's Preface. During the last years of his life, Professor Morgan had devoted much time and energy to the preparation of a translation of Vitruvius, which he proposed to supplement with a revised text, illustrations, and notes. He had completed the translation with the exception of the last four chapters of the 10th book, and had discussed with Professor Warren the illustrations intended for the first 6 books of the work. The notes had not been arranged or completed, though many of them were outlined in the manuscript, or the intention to insert them indicated. The several books of the translation, so far as it was completed, had been read to a little group of friends consisting of Professors Sheldon and Quittridge, and myself, and had received our criticism, which had, at times, been utilized in the revision of the work. After the death of Professor Morgan, in spite of my obvious incompetency from a technical point of view, I undertook, at the request of his family, to complete the translation, and to see the book through the press. I must therefore assume entire responsibility for the translation of the 10th book, beginning with chapter 13, and further responsibility for necessary changes made by me in the earlier part of the translation, changes which, in no case, affect any theory held by Professor Morgan, but which involve mainly the adoption of simpler forms of statements or the correction of obvious oversights. The text followed is that of Valentine Rose in the second edition, Leipzig, 1899, and the variations from this text are, with a few exceptions which are indicated in the footnotes, in the nature of a return to the consensus of the manuscript readings. The illustrations in the first 6 books are believed to be substantially in accord with the wishes of Professor Morgan. The suggestions for illustrations in the later books were incomplete and did not indicate in all cases with sufficient definiteness to allow them to be executed, the changes from conventional plans and designs intended by the translator. It has therefore been decided to include in this part of the work only those illustrations which are known to have had the full approval of Professor Morgan. The one exception to this principle is the production of a rough model of the Ram of Hegetor, constructed by me on the basis of the measurements given by Vitruvius and Athenaeus. It does not seem to me necessary, or even advisable, to enter into a long discussion as the date of Vitruvius, which has been assigned to various periods from the time of Augustus to the early centuries of our era. Professor Morgan, in several articles in the Harvard Studies in Classical Philology and in the Proceedings of the American Academy, all of which have been reprinted in a volume of Addresses and Essays, New York, 1909, upheld the now generally accepted view that Vitruvius wrote in the time of Augustus, and furnished conclusive evidence that nothing in his language is inconsistent with this view. In revising the translation, I met with one bit of evidence for a date before the end of the reign of Nero which I have never been adduced. In Book 8, Chapter 3, Section 21. The kingdom of Cottius is mentioned. The name depending, it is true, on an emendation, but one which has been universally accepted since it was first proposed in 1513. The kingdom of Cottius was made into a Roman province by Nero, and it is inconceivable that any Roman writer subsequently referred to it as a kingdom. It does seem necessary to add a few words about the literary merits of Vitruvius in this treatise, and about Professor Morgan's views as to the general principles to be followed in the translation. Vitruvius was not a great literary personage, ambitious as he was to appear in that character. As Professor Morgan has aptly said, he has all the marks of one unused to composition, to whom writing is a painful task. In his hand the measuring rod was a far mightier implement than the pen. His turgid and pompous rhetoric displays itself in the introductions to the different books, where his exaggerated effort to introduce some semblance of style into his commonplace lectures on the noble principles which should govern the conduct of the architect, or into the prosaic lists of architects and writers on architecture, is everywhere apparent. Even in the more technical portions of his work, a like conscious effort may be detected, and at the same time a lack of confidence in his ability to express himself in unmistakable language. He avoids periodic sentences, uses only the simpler subjunctive constructions, repeats the antecedent in relative clauses, and, not infrequently, adopts a formal language closely akin to that of specifications and contracts, the style with which he was naturally most familiar. He ends each book with a brief summary, almost a formula, somewhat like a sigh of relief in which the reader unconsciously shares. At times his meaning is ambiguous, not because of grammatical faults, which are comparatively few and unimportant, but because, when he does attempt a periodic sentence, he becomes involved and finds it difficult to extricate himself. Some of these peculiarities and crudities of expression Professor Morgan purposely imitated, because of his conviction that a translation should not merely reproduce the substance of a book, but should also give as clear a picture as possible of the original, of its author, and of the working of his mind. The translation is intended, then, to be faithful and exact, but it deliberately avoids any attempt to treat the language of Vitruvius as though it were Ciceronian, or to give a false impression of conspicuous literary merit in a work which is destitute of that quality. The translator had, however, the utmost confidence in the sincerity of Vitruvius and in the serious purpose of his treatise on architecture. To those who have liberally given their advice and suggestions in response to requests from Professor Morgan, it is impossible for me to make adequate acknowledgement. Their number is so great, and my knowledge of the in-depthness in individual cases is so small, that each must be content with the thought of the full and generous acknowledgement which he would have received had Professor Morgan himself written this preface. Personally, I am under the greatest obligations to Professor H. L. Warren, who has freely given both assistance and criticism, to Professor G. L. Kittredge, who has read with me most of the proof, to the syndics of the Harvard University Press, who have made possible the publication of the work, and to the members of the visiting committee of the Department of Classics and the classmates of Professor Morgan, who have generously supplied the necessary funds for the illustrations. Signed, Albert A. Howard. End of Translator's Preface. Book 1, Preface and Chapter 1 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Maurice Hickey Morgan. Book 1, Preface. 1. While your divine intelligence and will, Imperator Caesar, were engaged in acquiring the right to command the world, and while your fellow citizens, when all their enemies had been laid low by your invincible valor, were glorying in your triumph and victory, while all foreign nations were in subjection, awaiting your beck and call, and the Roman people and Senate, released from their alarm, were beginning to be guided by your most noble conceptions and policies. I hardly dared, in view of your serious employments, to publish my writings and long-considered ideas on architecture, for fear of subjecting myself to your displeasure by an unseasonable interruption. 2. But when I saw that you were giving your attention not only to the welfare of society in general and to the establishment of public order, but also to the providing of public buildings intended for utilitarian purposes, so that not only should the state have been enriched with provinces by your means, but that the greatness of its power might likewise be attended with distinguished authority in its public buildings, I thought that I ought to take the first opportunity to lay before you my writings on this theme. For in the first place it was this subject which made me known to your father, to whom I was devoted on account of his great qualities. After the counsel of heaven gave him a place in the dwellings of immortal life and transferred your father's power to your hands, my devotion continuing unchanged as I remembered him inclined me to support you. And so with Marcus Aurelius, Publius, Minidius, and Cneius Cornelius, I was ready to supply and repair ballistae, scorpiones, and other artillery, and I have received rewards for good service with them. After your first bestowal of these upon me, you continued to renew them on the recommendation of your sister. 3. Owing to this favour, I need to have no fear of want to the end of my life, and being thus laid under obligation, I began to write this work for you, because I saw that you have built, and are now building, extensively, and that in future also you will take care that our public and private buildings shall be worthy to go down to posterity by the side of your other splendid achievements. I have drawn up definite rules to enable you, by observing them, to have personal knowledge of the quality both of existing buildings and of those which are yet to be constructed. For in the following books I have disclosed all the principles of the art. Chapter 1. The Education of the Architect. 1. The architect should be equipped with knowledge of many branches of study and varied kinds of learning, for it is by his judgment that all work done by the other parts is put to test. This knowledge is the child of practice and theory. Practice is the continuous and regular exercise of employment where manual work is done with any necessary material according to the design of a drawing. Theory, on the other hand, is the ability to demonstrate and explain the productions of dexterity on the principles of proportion. 2. It follows, therefore, that architects who have aimed at acquiring manual skill without scholarships have never been able to reach a position of authority to correspond to their pains, while those who relied only upon theories and scholarship were obviously hunting the shadow, not the substance. But those who have a thorough knowledge of both, like men armed at all points, have the sooner attained their object and carried authority with them. 3. In all matters, but particularly in architecture, there are these two points: the thing signified, and that which gives it its significance. That which is signified is the subject of which we may be speaking, and that which gives significance is a demonstration on scientific principles. It appears then that one who professes himself an architect should be well versed in both directions. He ought therefore to be both naturally gifted and amenable to instruction. Neither natural ability without instruction, nor instruction without natural ability, can make the perfect artist. Let him be educated, skillful with the pencil, instructed in geometry, know much history, have followed the philosophers with attention, understand music, have some knowledge of medicine, know the opinions of the jurists, and be acquainted with astronomy and the theory of the heavens. 4. The reasons for all this are as follows. An architect ought to be an educated man so as to leave a more lasting remembrance in his treatises. Secondly, he must have a knowledge of drawing so that he can readily make sketches to show the appearance of the work which he proposes. Geometry also is of much assistance in architecture, and in particular it teaches us the use of the rule and compasses by which especially we acquire readiness in making plans for buildings in their grounds, and rightly apply the square, the level, and the plummet. By means of optics again, the light in buildings can be drawn from fixed quarters of the sky. It is true that it is by arithmetic that the total cost of buildings is calculated and measurements are computed. But difficult questions involving symmetry are solved by means of geometrical theories and methods. 5. A wide knowledge of history is requisite because, among the ornamental parts of an architect designed for a work, there are many the underlying idea of whose employment he should be able to explain to inquirers. For instance, suppose him to set up the marble statues of women in long robes, called caryatides, to take the place of columns. With the mutules and coronas placed directly above their heads, he will give the following explanations to his questionnaires. Caria, a state in Peloponnesus, sided with the Persian enemies against Greece. Later the Greeks, having gloriously won their freedom by victory in the war, made common cause and declared war against the people of Caria. They took the town, killed the men, abandoned the state to desolation, and carried off their wives into slavery, without permitting them, however, to lay aside the long robes and other marks of their rank as married women, so that they may be obliged not only to march in the triumph, but to appear forever after as a type of slavery, burdened with the weight of their shame, and so making atonement for their state. Hence the architects of the time designed for building statues of these women, placed so as to carry a load, in order that the sin and the punishment of the people of Caria might be known and handed down even to posterity. 6. Likewise the Lacedaemonians, under the leadership of Pausanias, son of Agesipolis, after conquering the Persian armies, infinite in number, with a small force of the Battle of Plataea, celebrated a glorious triumph with the spoils and booty, and with the money obtained from the sale thereof, build the Persian porch to be a monument to the renown and valor of the people and a trophy of victory for posterity. And there they set effigies of the prisoners arrayed in barbarian costume and holding up the roof, their pride punished by their deserved affront, that enemies might tremble for fear of the effects of their courage, and that their own people, looking upon this ensample of their valor and courage by the glory of it, might be ready to defend their independence. So from that time on, many had put up statues of Persians, supporting entablatures and their ornaments, and thus from that motive have greatly enriched the diversity of their works. There are other stories of the same kind which architects ought to know. 7. As for philosophy, it makes an architect high-minded and not self-assuming, but rather renders him courteous, just, and honest, without avariciousness. This is very important, for no work can be rightly done without honesty and incorruptibility. Let him not be grasping, nor have his mind preoccupied with the idea of receiving perquisites, but let him with dignity keep up his position by cherishing a good reputation. These are among the precepts of philosophy. Furthermore, philosophy treats of physics, where a more careful knowledge is required because the problems which come under his head are numerous and of very different kinds, as, for example, in the case of the conducting of water. For at points of intake and at curves and at places where it is raised to a level, currents of air naturally form in one way or another, and nobody who has not learned the fundamental principles of physics from philosophy will be able to provide against the damage which they do. So the reader of Ctesibius or Archimedes and the other writers of treatises of the same class will not be able to appreciate them unless he has been trained in these subjects by the philosophers. 8. Music also the architect ought to understand so that he may have knowledge of the canonical and mathematical theory, and besides be able to tune ballistae, catapultae, and scorpions to the proper key. For to the right and left in the beams are the holes in the frames through which the strings of twisted sinew are stretched by means of windlasses and bars, and these strings must not be clamped and made fast until they give the same correct note to the ear of the skilled workman. For the arms thrust through those stretched strings must, on being let go, strike their blow together at the same moment, but if they are not in the unison, they will prevent the course of projectiles from being straight. 9. In theatres likewise there are the bronze vessels, which are placed in niches under the seats in accordance with the musical intervals on mathematical principles. These vessels are arranged with a view to musical concords or harmony, and apportioned in the compass of the fourth, the fifth, and octave, and so on up to the double octave, in such a way that when the voice of an actor falls in unison with any of them, its power is increased, and it reaches the ears of the audience with greater clearness and sweetness. Water organs, too, and the other instruments which resemble them cannot be made by one who is without the principles of music. 10. The architect should also have a knowledge of the study of medicine on account of the questions of climates, air, the healthiness and unhealthiness of sites, and the use of different waters. For without these considerations, the healthiness of a dwelling cannot be assured. And as for the principles of law, he should know those which are necessary in the case of buildings having party walls, with regard to water dripping from the eaves, and also the laws about drains, windows, and water supply. And other things of this sort should be known to architects, so that, before they begin upon buildings, they may be careful not to leave disputed points for the householders to settle after the works are finished, and so that in drawing up contracts the interest of both employer and contractor may be wisely safeguarded. For if a contract is skillfully drawn, each may obtain a release from the other without disadvantage. From astronomy we find the east, west, south, and north, as well as the theory of the heavens, the equinox, solstice, and courses of the stars. If one has no knowledge of these matters, he will not be able to have any comprehension of the theory of sundials. 11. Consequently, since this study is so vast in extent, embellished and enriched as it is with many different kinds of learning, I think that men have no right to profess themselves architects hastily, without having climbed from boyhood the steps of these studies, and thus, nursed by the knowledge of many arts and sciences, having reached the heights of the holy ground of architecture. 12. But perhaps to the inexperienced it will seem a marvel that human nature can comprehend such a great number of studies and keep them in the memory. Still, the observations that all studies have a common bond of union and intercourse with one another will lead to the belief that this can easily be realized. For a liberal education forms, as it were, a single body made up of these members. So, therefore, who from tender years receive instructions in the various forms of learning, recognize the same stamp on all the arts, and an intercourse between all studies, and so they more readily comprehend them all. This is what led one of the ancient architects, Pytheas, the celebrated builder of the temple of Minerva at Priene, to say in his commentaries that an architect ought to be able to accomplish much more in all the arts than in sciences than the men who, by their own particular kinds of work and the practice of it, have brought each a single subject to the highest perfection. But this is, in point of fact, not realized. 13. For an architect ought not be, and cannot be, such a philologian as was Aristarchus, although not illiterate, nor a musician like Aristoxenus, though not absolutely ignorant of music, nor a painter like Apelles, though not unskillful in drawing, nor a sculptor, such as was Myron or Polycletus, though not unacquainted with the plastic art, nor again a physician like Hippocrates, though not ignorant of medicine, nor in the other sciences need he excel in each, though he should not be unskilful in them. For, in the midst of all this great variety of subjects, an individual cannot attain to perfection in each, because it is scarcely in his power to take in and comprehend the general theories of them. 14. Still, it is not architects alone that cannot in all matters reach perfection, but even men who individually practice specialities in the arts do not all attain to the highest point of merit. Therefore, if among artists working each in the single field, not all, but only a few in an entire generation acquire fame, and that with difficulty, how can an architect, who has to be skilful in many arts, accomplish not merely the feat, in itself a great marvel, of being deficient in none of them, but also that of surpassing all those artists who have devoted themselves with unremitting industry to single fields? 15. It appears, then, that Pythias made a mistake by not observing that the arts are each composed of two things, the actual work and the theory of it. One of these, the doing of the work, is proper to men trained in the individual subject, while the other, the theory, is common to all scholars. For example, to physicians and musicians, the rhythmical beat of the pulse and its metrical movement. But if there is a wound to be healed or a sick man to be saved from danger, the musician will not call, for the business will be appropriate to the physician. So in the case of a musical instrument, not the physician but the musician will be the man to tune it so that the ears may find their due pleasure in its strains. 16. Astronomers likewise have a common ground for discussion with musicians in the harmony of the stars and musical concords and tetrads and triads of the fourth and the fifth, and with geometricians in the subject of vision, and in all sciences many points, perhaps all, are common so far as the discussion of them is concerned. But the actual undertaking of works which are brought to perfection by the hand and its manipulation is the function of those who have been specially trained to deal with the single art. It appears, therefore, that he has done enough and to spare who in each subject possesses a fairly good knowledge of those parts, with their principles, which are indispensable for architecture. So that if he is acquired to pass judgment and to express approval in the case of those things or art, he may not be found wanting. As for men upon whom nature has bestowed so much ingenuity, acuteness, and memory that they are able to have thorough knowledge of geometry, astronomy, music, and the other arts, they go beyond the functions of architects and become pure mathematicians. Hence they can readily take up positions against those arts, because many are the artistic weapons which with they are armed. Such men, however, are rarely found, but there have been such at times, for example, Aristarchus of Samos, Philolaus and Archytas of Tarentum, Apollonius of Perga, Eratosthenes of Cyrene, and among Syracusans, Archimedes and Scopinas, who through mathematics and natural philosophy discovered, expounded, and left to posterity many things in connection with mechanics and with sundials. 17. Since, therefore, the possession of such talents due to natural capacity is not vouchsafed at random to entire nations, but only to a few great men, since, moreover, the function of the architects requires a training in all the departments of learning, and finally, since reason, on account of the wide extent of the subject, concedes that he may possess not the highest, but not even necessarily a moderate knowledge of the subject of study, I request Caesar, both of you, and of those who may read the said books, that if anything is set forth with too little regard for grammatical rule, it may be pardoned. For it is not as a very great philosopher, nor as an eloquent rhetorician, nor as a grammarian trained in the highest principle of his art, that I have striven to write this work, but as an architect, who has had only a dip into those studies. Still, as regard, the efficacy of the art and the theories of it, I promise and expect that in these volumes I shall undoubtedly show myself of very considerable importance, not only to builders, but also to all scholars. End of Book 1, Chapter 1. Book 1, Chapters 2 to 3 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 2. The Fundamental Principles of Architecture. 1. Architecture depends on order, arrangement, symmetry, arrhythmy, propriety, and economy. 2. Order gives due measure to the members of a work considered separately, and symmetrical agreement to the proportions of the whole. It is an adjustment according to quantity. By this I mean the selection of modules from the members of the work itself, and starting from these individual parts of members, constructing the whole work to correspond. Arrangement includes the putting of things in their proper places, and the elegance of effect, which is due to adjustments appropriate to the character of the work. Its forms of expression are these: ground plan, elevation, and perspective. A ground plan is made by the proper successive use of compasses and rule, through which we get outlines for the plane surfaces of the buildings. An elevation is a picture of the front of a building, set upright and properly drawn in the proportions of the contemplated work. Perspective is the method of sketching a front with the sides withdrawing into the background, the lines all meeting in the center of a circle. All three come of reflection and invention. Reflection is careful and laborious thought and watchful attention directed to the agreeable effect of one's plan. Invention, on the other hand, is the solving of intricate problems and the discovery of new principles by means of brilliancy and versatility. These are the departments belonging under arrangement. Arrhythmy is beauty and fitness in the adjustment of the members. This is found when the members of a work are of a height suited to their breadth, of a breadth suited to their length, and, in a word, when they all correspond symmetrically. 4. Symmetry is a proper agreement between the members of the work itself, and relation between the different parts and the whole general scheme, in accordance with a certain part selected as standard. Thus, in the human body there is a kind of symmetrical harmony between forearm, foot, palm, finger, and other small parts, and so it is with perfect buildings. In the case of temples, symmetry may be calculated from the thickness of a column, from a triglyph, or even from a module. In the ballista, from the hole or from what the Greeks call the peritretos. In a ship, from the space between the thole pins, and in other things, from various members. Propriety is that perfection of style which comes when a work is authoritatively constructed on approved principles. It arises from prescription, from usage, or from nature. From prescription, in the case of hypaethral edifices, open to the sky in honor of Jupiter, lightning, the heaven, the sun, or the moon. For these are gods whose semblances and manifestations we behold before our very eyes in the sky when it is cloudless and bright. The temples of Minerva, Mars, and Hercules will be Doric, since the virile strength of these gods makes daintiness entirely inappropriate to their houses. In temples to Venus, Flora, Proserpine, Springwater, and the Nymphs, The Corinthian order will be found to have peculiar significance because these are delicate divinities, and so its rather slender outlines, its flowers, leaves, and ornamental volutes will lend propriety where it is due. The construction of temples of the Ionic order to Juno, Diana, Father Bacchus, and the other gods of that kind will be in keeping with the middle position which they hold, for the building of such will be an appropriate combination of the severity of Doric and the delicacy of the Corinthian. 6. Propriety arises from usage when buildings having magnificent interiors are provided with elegant entrance courts to correspond. For there will be no propriety in the spectacle of an elegant interior approached by a low, mean entrance. Or, if dentils be carved in the cornice of the Doric entablature or triglyphs represented in the Ionic entablature of the cushion-shaped capitals of the columns, the effect will be spoilt by the transfer of the peculiarities of the one order of the building to the other, the usage in each class having been fixed long ago. 7. Finally, propriety will be due to natural causes if, for example, in the case of all sacred precincts, we select very healthy neighborhoods with suitable springs of water in the places where the fanes are to be built, particularly in the case of those to Aesculapius and to Health, gods by whose healing powers great numbers of the sick are apparently cured. For when their diseased bodies are transformed from an unhealthy to a healthy spot, and treated with waters from health-giving springs, they will the more speedily grow well. The result will be that the divinity will stand in higher esteem and find his dignity increased, all owing to the nature of his sight. There will also be natural propriety in using an eastern light for bedrooms and libraries, a western light in winter for baths and wintered apartments, and a northern light for picture galleries and other places in which a steady light is needed. For that quarter of the sky grows neither light nor dark with the course of the sun, but remains steady and unshifting all day long. 8. Economy denotes the proper management of materials and of site, as well as a thrifty balancing of cost and common sense in the construction of works. This will be observed if, in the first place, the architect does not demand things which cannot be found or made ready without great expense. For example, it is not everywhere that there is plenty of pitsand, rubble, fir, clear fir, and marble, since they are produced in different places, and to assemble them is difficult and costly. Where there is no pitsand, we must use the kinds washed up by rivers or by the sea. The lack of fir and clear fir may be evaded by using cypress, poplar, elm, or pine, and other problems we must solve in similar ways. 9. A second stage in economy is reached when we have to plan the different kinds of dwellings suitable for ordinary householders, for great wealth, or for the high position of the statesman. A house in town obviously calls for one form of construction, that into which stream the products of country estates requires another. This will not be the same in the case of moneylenders, and still different for the opulent and luxurious. For the powers under those deliberations, the commonwealth is guided dwellings are to be provided according to their special needs. And, in a word, the proper form of economy must be observed in building houses for each and every class. Chapter 3. The Departments of Architecture. 1. There are three departments of architecture: the art of building, the making of timepieces, and the construction of machinery. Building is, in its turn divided into two parts, of which the first is the construction of fortified towns and of works for general use in public places, and the second is the putting up of structures for private individuals. There are three classes of public buildings, the first for defensive, the second for religious, and the third for utilitarian purposes. Under defense comes the planning of walls, towers, and gates, permanent devices for resistance against hostile attacks. Under religion, the erection of fanes and temples to the immortal gods. Under utility, the provision of meeting places for public use, such as harbors, markets, colonnades, baths, theaters, promenades, and all other similar arrangements in public places. 2. All these must be built with due reference to durability, convenience, and beauty. Durability will be assured when foundations are carried down to the solid ground and materials wisely and liberally selected. Convenience, when the arrangement of the apartments is faultless and presents no hindrance to use, and when each class of building is assigned to its suitable and appropriate exposure. And beauty, when the appearance of the work is pleasing, and in good taste, and when its members are in due proportion according to correct principles of symmetry. End of Book 1, Chapter 3. Book 1, Chapters 4 to 5 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitrivius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 4. The Site of a City. 1. For fortified towns, the following general principles are to be observed. First comes the choice of a very healthy site. Such a site will be high, neither misty nor frosty, and in a climate neither hot nor cold, but temperate. Further, without marshes in the neighborhood. For when the morning breezes blow toward the town at sunrise, if they bring with them mists from the marshes, and mingle with the mist the poisonous breath of the creatures of the marshes to be wafted into the bodies of the inhabitants, they will make the site unhealthy. Again, if the town is on the coast with a southern or western exposure, it will not be healthy, because in summer the southern sky grows hot at sunrise and is fiery at noon, while a western exposure grows warm after sunrise, is hot at noon, and at evening all aglow. 2. These variations in heat and the subsequent cooling off are harmful to the people living on such sites. The same conclusion may be reached in the case of inanimate things. For instance, nobody draws the light for covered wine rooms from the south or west, but rather from north, since the quarter is never subject to change but is always constant and unshifting. So it is with granaries. Grain exposed to the sun's course soon loses its good quality, and provisions and fruit, unless stored in a place unexposed to the sun's course, do not keep long. 3. For heat is a universal solvent, melting out of things their power of resistance and sucking away and removing their natural strength with its fiery exhalations, so they grow soft and hence weak under its glow. We see this in the case of iron, which, however hard it may naturally be, yet, when heated thoroughly in a furnace fire, can be easily worked into any kind of shape, and still, if cooled, while it is soft and white-hot, it hardens again with a mere dip in cold water and takes on its former quality. 4. We may recognize the truth of this from the fact that in summer the heat makes everybody weak, not only in unhealthy but even in healthy places, and that in winter even the most unhealthy districts are much healthier because they are given a solidity by the cooling off. Similarly, Persons removed from cold countries to hot cannot endure it but waste away, whereas those who pass from hot places to the cold regions of the north not only do not suffer in health from the change of residence, but even gain by it. 5. It appears, then, that in founding towns we must beware of districts from which hot winds can spread abroad over the inhabitants. For while all bodies are composed of the four elements, that is, of heat, moisture, the earthy, and the air, yet there are mixtures according to natural temperament which make up the natures of all the different animals of the world, each after its kind. 6. Therefore, if one of these elements, heat, becomes predominant in any body whatsoever, it destroys and dissolves all the others with its violence. This defect may be due to violent heat from certain quarters of the sky, pouring into the open pores in too great proportion to admit of a mixture suited to the natural temperament of the body in question. Again, if too much moisture enters the channels of a body, and thus introduces disproportion, the other elements, adulterated by the liquid, are impaired, and the virtues of the mixture dissolve. This defect, in turn, may arise from the cooling properties of moist winds and breezes blowing upon the body. In the same way, increase or diminution of the proportion of air and of the earthy, which is natural to the body, may enfeeble the other elements, the predominance of the earthy being due to overmuch food, that of air to a heavy atmosphere. 7. If one wishes a more accurate understanding of all this, he need only consider and observe the natures of birds, fishes, and land animals, and he will thus come to reflect upon distinctions of temperament. One form of mixture is proper to birds, another to fishes, and a far different form to land animals. Winged creatures have less of the earthy, less moisture, heat in moderation, air in large amount. Being made up, therefore, of the lighter elements, they can more readily soar away into the air. Fish, with their aquatic nature, being moderately supplied with heat and made up in part of air and the earthy, with as little moisture as possible, can more easily exist in moisture for the very reason that they have less of it than of the other elements in their bodies. And so, when they are drawn to land, they leave life and water at the same moment. Similarly, the land animals, being moderately supplied with the elements of air and heat, and having less of the earthy and a great deal of moisture, cannot long continue alive in the water, because their proportion of moisture is already abundant. 8. Therefore, if all this, as we have explained, our reason showing us that the bodies of animals are made up of the element, and these bodies, as we believe, giving away and breaking up as a result of excess or deficiency in this or that element, we cannot but believe that we must take great care to select a very temperate climate for the site of our city, since healthfulness is, as we have said, the first requisite. 9. I cannot too strongly insist upon the need of a return to the method of old times. Our ancestors, when about to build a town or an army post, sacrificed some of the cattle that were wont to feed on the site proposed, and examined their livers. If the livers of the first victims were dark-colored or abnormal, they sacrificed others to see whether the fault was due to disease or their food. They never began to build defensive works in a place until after they had made many such trials and satisfied themselves that good water and food had made the liver sound and firm. If they continued to find it abnormal, they argued from this that the food and water supply found in such a place would be just as unhealthy for man, and so they moved away and changed to another neighborhood, healthfulness being their chief object. 10. That pasture and food may indicate the healthful qualities of a site is a fact which can be observed and investigated in the case of certain pastures in Crete, on each side of the river Potherias, which separates the two Cretan states of Gnosus and Gortyna. There are cattle at pasture on the right and left banks of that river, but while the cattle that feed near Gnosus have the usual spleen, those on the other side near Gortyna have no perceptible spleen. On investigating the subject, physicians discovered on this side a kind of herb which the cattle chew and thus make their spleen small. The herb is therefore gathered and used as a medicine for the cure of splenetic people. The Cretans call it hasplenon. From food and water, then, we may learn whether sites are naturally unhealthy or healthy. 11. If the walled town is built among the marshes themselves, provided that they are by the sea, with a northern or northeastern exposure, and are above the level of the seashore, the site will be reasonable enough. For ditches can be dug to let out the water to the shore, and also in times of storms the sea swells and comes back up into the marshes, where its bitter blend prevents the reproductions of the usual marsh creatures, while any that swim down from the higher levels to the shore are killed at once by the saltness to which they are unused. An instance of this may be found in the Gallic marshes surrounding Altino, Ravenna, Aquileia, and other towns and places of the kind, close by marshes. They are marvelously healthy for the reason which I have given. 12. But marshes that are stagnant and have no outlets, either by rivers or ditches, like the Pomptine marshes, merely putrefy as they stand, emitting heavy, unhealthy vapors. A case of a town built in such a spot was Old Salpia in Apulia, founded by Diomed on his way back from Troy, or, according to some writers, by Elpias of Rhodes. Year after year there was sickness, until finally the suffering inhabitants came with a public petition to Marcus Hostilius and got him to agree to seek and find them a proper place to which to remove their city. Without delay he made the most skillful investigations and at once purchased an estate near the sea in a healthy place and asked the Senate and Roman people for permission to remove the town. He constructed the walls and laid out the house lots, granting one to each citizen for a mere trifle. This done, he cut an opening from a lake into the sea, and thus made of the lake a harbour for the town. The result is that now the people of Salpia live on a healthy site, and at a distance of only 4 miles from the old town. Chapter 5. The City Walls. 1. After ensuring on these principles the healthfulness of the future city and selecting a neighborhood that can supply plenty of foodstuffs to maintain the community with good roads or else convenient rivers or seaports affording easy means of transport to the city, the next thing to do is to lay the foundations for the towers and walls. Dig down to solid bottom, if it can be found, and lay them therein, going as deep as the magnitude of the proposed work seems to require. They should be much thicker than the parts of the wall that will appear above ground, and their structure should be as solid as it can possibly be laid. 2. The towers must be projected beyond the line of the wall, so that an enemy wishing to approach the wall to carry it by assault may be exposed to the fire of missiles on his open flank from the towers on his right and left. Special pains should be taken that there be no easy avenue by which to storm the wall. The road should be encompassed at steep points, and planned so as to approach the gates not in straight line, but from the right to the left, for as a result of this, the right-hand side of the assailants, unprotected by their shields, will be next to the wall. Town should be laid out not as an exact square, nor with salient angles, but in circular forms, to give a view of the enemy from many points. Defense is difficult where there are salient angles, because the angle protects the enemy rather than the inhabitants. 3. The thickness of the wall should, in my opinion, be such that armed men meeting on top of it may pass one another without interference. In the thickness there should be set a very close succession of ties made of charred olive wood, binding the two faces of the wall together like pins, to give it a lasting endurance. For that is a material which neither decay, nor the weather, nor time can harm, for even though buried in the earth, or set in the water, it keeps sound and useful forever. And so not only city walls, but substructures in general, and all walls that require a thickness, like that of a city wall, will be long in failing to decay if tied in this manner. 4. The tower should be set at intervals of not more than a bowshot apart, so that, in case of an assault upon any one of them, the enemy may be repulsed with scorpions and other means of hurling missiles from the towers to the right and left. Opposite the inner side of every tower, the wall should be interrupted for a space the width of the tower, and have only a wooden flooring across, leading to the interior of the tower but not firmly nailed. This is to be cut away by the defenders in case the enemy gets possession of any portion of the wall, and if the work is quickly done, the enemy will not be able to make his way to the other towers and the rest of the wall unless he is ready to face a fall. 5. The towers themselves must be either round or polygonal. Square towers are sooner shattered by military engines, for the battering rams pound their angles to pieces. But in the case of round towers, they can do no harm, being engaged, as it were, in driving wedges to their center. The system of fortification by wall and towers may be made safest by the addition of earthen ramparts, for neither rams, nor mining, nor other engineering devices can do them any harm. 6. The rampart form of defense, however, is not required in all places, but only where outside the wall there is a high ground from which an assault on the fortifications may be made over a level space lying between. In place of this kind, we must first make very wide, deep ditches. Next sink foundation for a wall in the bed of the ditch and build them thick enough to support an earthwork with ease. 7. Then within this substructure lay a second foundation, far enough inside the first to leave ample room for cohorts in line of battle to take position on the broad top of the rampart for its defense. Having laid these two foundations at this distance from another, build cross walls between them, uniting the outer and inner foundation in a comb-like arrangement, set like the teeth of a saw. With this form of construction, the enormous burden of earth will be distributed into small bodies, and will not lie with all its weight in one crushing mass so as to thrust out the substructures. 8. With regard to the material of which the actual wall should be constructed or finished, there can be no definite prescription, because we cannot obtain in all places the supplies that we desire. Dimension, stone, flint, rubble, burnt or unburnt brick, use them as you find them, for it is not every neighborhood or particular locality that can have a wall built of burnt brick like that of Babylon, where there was plenty of asphalt to take the place of lime and sand, and yet possibly each may be provided with materials of equal usefulness, so that out of them a faultless wall may be built to last forever. 1, Chapter 5. Book 1, Chapters 6 to 7 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 6. The directions of the street with remarks on the winds. 1. The town being fortified, the next step is the apportionment of house lots within the walls and the laying out of streets and alleys with regard to climatic conditions. They will be properly laid out if foresight is employed to exclude the winds from the alleys. Cold winds are disagreeable, hot winds enervating, moist winds unhealthy. We must therefore avoid mistakes in this matter and beware of the common experience of many communities. For example, Mytilene, in the island of Lesbos, is a town built with magnificence and good taste, but its position shows a lack of foresight. In that community, when the wind is south, the people fall ill. When it is northwest, it sets them coughing. With a north wind, they do indeed recover, but cannot stand about in alleys and streets owing to the severe cold. 2. Wind is a flowing wave of air, moving hither and thither indefinitely. It is produced when heat meets moisture, the rush of heat generating a mighty current of air. That this is the fact we may learn from bronze eolipiles, and thus by means of scientific inventions discover a divine truth lurking in the laws of the heavens. Eolipiles are hollow bronze balls with a very small opening through which water is poured into them. Set before a fire, not a breath issues from them before they get warm, but as soon as they begin to boil, out comes a strong blast due to the fire. Thus, from this slight and very short experiment, we may understand and judge of the mighty and wonderful laws of the heavens and the nature of winds. By shutting out the winds from our dwellings, therefore, we shall not only make the place healthful for people who are well, but also in the case of diseases, due perhaps to unfavorable situations elsewhere, the patients who in other healthy places might be cured by a different form of treatment, will here be more quickly cured by the mildness that comes from the shutting out of the winds. The diseases which are hard to cure in neighborhoods such as those to which I have referred above are catarrh, hoarseness, coughs, pleurisy, consumption, spitting of blood, and all others that are cured not by lowering the system but by building it up. They are hard to cure, first, because they are originally due to chills, secondly, because the patient's system, being already exhausted by disease, the air there, which is in constant agitation owing to winds and therefore deteriorated, takes all the sap of life out of the diseased bodies and leaves them more meager every day. On the other hand, a mild, thick air, without draughts and not constantly blowing back and forth, builds up their frames by its unwavering steadiness, and so strengthens and restores people who are afflicted with these diseases. 4. Some have held that there are only four winds: Solanus from due east, Auster from the south, Favonius from due west, Septentrio from the north. But more careful investigators tell us that there are eight. Chief among such was Andronicus of Cyrus, who in proof built the marble octagonal tower in Athens. On the several sides of the octagon he executed reliefs representing the several winds, each facing the point from which it blows, and on top of the tower he sets a conical-shaped piece of marble, and on this a bronze triton with a rod outstretched in its right hand. It was so contrived as to go round with the winds, always stopping to face the breeze and holding its rod as a pointer directly over the representation of the wind that was blowing. 5. Thus Eurus is placed to the southeast between Solanus and Auster, Africus to the southwest between Auster and Favonius, Caurus, or as many call it, Chorus, between Favonius and Septentrio, and Aquilo between Septentrio and Solanus. Such, then, appears to have been his device, including the numbers and names of the wind and indicating the directions from which particular winds blow. These facts being thus determined, to find the directions and quarters of the winds, your method of procedure should be as follows. 6. In the middle of the city, place a marble amosium, laying it true by the level, or else let the spot be made so true by means of rule and level that no amosium is necessary. In the very center of that spot, set up a bronze gnomon, or shadow tracker, in Greek, skiatras. At about the fifth hour in the morning, Take the end at the shadow cast by this gnomon and mark it with a point. Then, opening your compasses to this point which marks the length of the gnomon's shadow, describe a circle from the center. In the afternoon, watch the shadow of your gnomon as it lengthens, and when it once more touches the circumference of this circle, and the shadow in the afternoon is equal in length to that of the morning, mark it with a point. 7. From these two points, describe with your compasses intersecting arcs, and through their intersection and the center let a line be drawn to the circumference of the circle to give us the quarters of south and north. Then, using a 1/16 part of the entire circumference of the circle as a diameter, describe a circle with its center on the line to the south at the point where it crosses the circumference, and put points to the right and left on the circumference on the south side, repeating the process on the north side. From the four points thus obtained, draw lines intersecting the center from one side of the circumference to the other. Thus, we shall have an 1/8 part of the circumference set out for Auster and another for Serpentrio. The rest of the entire circumference is then to be divided into 3 equal parts on each side, and thus we have designed a figure equally apportioned among the 8 winds. Then let the directions of your streets and alleys be laid down on the lines of division between the quarters of 2 winds. 8. On this principle of arrangement, the disagreeable force of the winds will be shut out from dwellings and lines of houses. For if the streets run full in the face of the winds, their constant blasts rushing in from the open country, and then confined by narrow alleys, will sweep through them with great violence. The lines of houses must therefore be directed away from the quarters from which the winds blow, so that as they come in they may strike against the angles of the blocks and their force thus be broken and dispersed. 9. Those who know names for very many winds will perhaps be surprised at our setting forth that there are only 8. Remembering, however, that Eratosthenes of Cyrene, employing mathematical theories and geometrical methods, discovered from the course of the sun the shadows cast by an equinoctial gnomon and the inclination of the heaven, that the circumference of the earth is 252,000 stadia, that is, 31,500,000 paces, and observing that an 1/8 part of this, occupied by a wind, is 3,937,500 paces, they should not be surprised to find that a single wind, ranging over so wide a field, is subject to shifts this way and that, leading to a variety of breezes. 10. So we often have Laconitus and Alternus blowing respectively to the right and left of Auster, Libonitus and Subversperus to the right and left of Africus, Argestes, and at certain periods the Etesiae on either side of Favonius, Circias and Corus on the sides of Caurus, Thrasias and Gallicus on either side of Serpentrio, Supernas and Cisias to the right and left of Aquilo, Carbas, and at certain period the Ornithiae on either side of Solanus, while Eurycircias and Volturnus blow on the flanks of Eurus, which is between them. There are also many other names for winds derived from localities or from the squalls which sweep from rivers or down mountains. 11. Then, too, there are breezes of early morning, for the sun on emerging from beneath the earth strikes humid air as he returns, and as he goes up climbing the sky he spreads it out before him, extracting breezes from the vapor that was there before the dawn. Those that still blow on after sunrise are classed with Euros, and hence appears to come the Greek name, Euros, as the child of the breezes, and the word for tomorrow, Orion, named from their early morning breezes. Some people do indeed say that Eratosthenes could not have inferred the true measure of the earth. Whether true or untrue, it cannot affect the truth of what I have written on the fixing of the quarters from which the different winds blow. 12. If he was wrong, the only result will be that the individual winds may blow, not with the scope expected from his measurement, but with the powers either more or less widely extended. For the readier understanding of these topics, since I have treated them with brevity, it has seemed best to me to give two figures, or, as the Greeks say, schemata, at the end of this book. One decides to show the precise quarters from which the winds arise, the other, how by turning the directions of the rows of houses and the streets away from their full force, we may avoid unhealthy blasts. Let A be the center of a plane surface, and B the point to which the shadow of the gnomon reaches in the morning. Taking A as the center, open the compasses to the point B which marks the shadow and describe a circle. Put the gnomon back where it was before, and wait for the shadow to lessen and grow again until in the afternoon it is equal to its length in the morning, touching the circumference at the point C. Then, from the points B and C, describe with the compasses two arcs intersecting at D. Next, draw a line from the point of intersection D through the center of the circle to the circumference and call it EF. This line will show where the south and north lie. 13. Then find with the compasses a 16th part of the entire circumference. Then center the compasses on the point E where the line to the south touches the circumference, and set off the points G and H to the right and left of E. Otherwise, on the north side, center the compasses on the circumference at the point F on the line to the north and set off the points I and K to the right and left. Then draw lines through the center from G to K and from H to I. Thus the space from G to H will belong to Auster and the south, and the space from I to K will be that of Septentrio. The north of the circumference is to be divided equally into three parts on the right and three on the left, those to the east at the points L and M, those to the west at the points N and O. Finally, intersecting lines are to be drawn from M to O and from L to N. Thus we shall have the circumference divided into eight equal spaces for the winds. The figure being finished, we shall have at the eight different divisions, beginning at the south, the letter G from Euros and Auster, H between Auster and Africus, N between Africus and Favonius, O between Favonius and Chorus, K between Chorus and Septentrio, I between Septentrio and Aquilo, L between Aquilo and Solanus, and M between Solanus and Euros. This done, apply a gnomon to these eight divisions, and thus fix the directions of the different alleys. Chapter 7. The Sites for Public Buildings. 1. Having laid out the alleys and determined the streets, we have next to treat the choice of building sites for temples, the forum, and all other public spaces, with a view to general convenience and utility. If the city is on the sea, we should choose ground close to the harbour as the place where the forum is to be built, but if inland, in the middle of the town. For the temples, the sites for those of the gods under whose particular protection the state is thought to rest, and for Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, should be on the very highest point commanding a view of the greater part of the city. Mercury should be in the forum, or, like Isis and Serapis, in the emporium. Apollo and Father Bacchus near the theatre. Hercules at the circus in the communities which have no gymnasia nor amphitheatres, Mars outside the city but at the training ground, and so Venus but at the harbour. It is moreover shown by the Etruscan diviners in treatises on their science that the fanes of Venus, Vulcan, and Mars should be situated outside the walls, in order that the young men and women may not become habituated in the city to the temptations incident to the worship of Venus, and that buildings may be free from the terror of fires through the religious rites and sacrifices which call the power of Vulcan beyond the walls. As for Mars, when that divinity is enshrined outside the walls, the citizens will never take up arms against each other, and he will defend the city from its enemies and save it from danger in war. 2. Ceres should also be outside the city, in a place to which people need never go except for the purpose of sacrifice. That place should be under the protection of religion, purity, and good morals. proper sites should be set apart for the precincts of the other gods according to the nature of the sacrifices offered to them. The principle governing the actual construction of temples and their symmetry I shall explain in my third and fourth books. In the second, I have thought it best to give an account of the materials used in buildings with their good qualities and advantages, and then in the succeeding books to describe and explain the proportions of buildings, their arrangements, and the different forms of symmetry. End of Book 1. Book 2, Introduction, and Chapters 1 to 2 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 2, Introduction. 1. Dinocrates, an architect who was full of confidence in his own ideas and skill, set out from Macedonia in the reign of Alexander to go to the army, being eager to win the approbation of the king. He took with him from his country letters from relatives and friends to the principal military men and officers of the court, in order to gain access to them more readily. Being politely received by them, he asked to be presented to Alexander as soon as possible. They promised, but were rather slow, waiting for a suitable opportunity. So Dinocrates, thinking that they were playing with him, had recourse to his own efforts. He was of very lofty stature and pleasing countenance, finely formed, and extremely dignified. Trusting, therefore, to these natural gifts, he undressed himself in his inn, anointed his body with oil, set a chaplet of poplar leaves on his head, draped his left shoulder with a lion skin, and holding a club in his right hand, stalked forth to a place in front of the tribunal where the king was administering justice. 2. His strange appearance made the people turn round, and this led Alexander to look at him. In astonishment, he gave orders to make way for him to draw near, and asked who he was. "Dinocrates," quoth he, "a Macedonian architect who brings thee ideas and designs worthy of thy renown. I have made a design for the shaping of Mount Athos into the statue of a man, in whose left hand I have represented a very spacious, fortified city, and his right a bowl to receive the water of all the streams which are in that mountain, so that it may pour from the bowl into the sea." 3. On finding that this was impossible without transport from beyond the sea, "Dinocrates," quoth he, "I appreciate your design as excellent in composition, and I am delighted with it, but I apprehend that anybody who should found a city in that spot would be censured for bad judgment. For as a newborn babe cannot be nourished without the nurse's milk, nor conducted to the approaches that lead to growth in life, so a city cannot thrive without fields and the fruits thereof pouring into its wall, nor have a large population without plenty of food, nor maintain its population without a supply of it. Therefore, while thinking that your design is commendable, I consider the site as not commendable, but I would have you stay with me, because I mean to make use of your services." 4. From that time, Dinocrates did not leave the king, but followed him into Egypt. There Alexander, observing a harbour rendered safe by nature, an excellent centre for trade, cornfields throughout all Egypt, and the great usefulness of the mighty river Nile, ordered him to build the city of Alexandria, named after the king. This was how Dinocrates, recommended only by his good looks and dignified carriage, came to be so famous. But as for me, emperor, nature has not given me stature. Age has marred my face, and my strength is impaired by ill health. Therefore, since these advantages fail me, I shall win your approval, as I hope, by the help of my knowledge and my writings. 5. In my first book, I have said what I had to say about the functions of architecture and the scope of the art, as well as about fortified towns and the apportionment of building sites within the fortifications. Although it would next be in order to explain the proper proportions and symmetry of temples and public buildings, as well as of private houses, I thought best to postpone this until after I had treated the practical merits of the materials out of which, when they are brought together, buildings are constructed with due regard to their proper kind of material for each part, and until I had shown of what natural elements those materials are composed. But before beginning to explain their natural properties, I will prefix the motives which originally gave rise to buildings and the development of inventions in this field, following in the steps of early nature and of those writers who have devoted treatises to the origins of civilization and the investigation of inventions. My exposition will, therefore, follow the instruction which I have received from them. Chapter 1. The Origin of the Dwelling House. 1. The men of old were born like the wild beasts, in woods, caves, and groves, and lived on savage fare. As time went on, the thickly crowded trees in a certain place, tossed by storms and winds and rubbing their branches against one another, caught fire, and so the inhabitants of the place were put to flight, being terrified by the furious flame. After it subsided, they drew near, and observing that they were very comfortable standing before the warm fire, they put on logs, and while thus keeping it alive, brought up other people to it, showing them by signs how much comfort they got from it. In that gathering of men, at a time when utterance of sound was purely individual, from daily habits they fixed upon articulate words just as these had happened to come, then from indicating by name things in common use, the result was that in this chance way they began to talk, and thus originated conversation with one another. 2. Therefore, it was the discovery of fire that originally gave rise to the coming together of men, to the deliberative assembly, and to social intercourse. And so, as they kept coming together in greater numbers into one place, finding themselves naturally gifted beyond the other animals in not being obliged to walk with faces to the ground, but upright, and gazing upon the splendor of the starry firmament, and also being able to do with ease whatever they chose with their hands and fingers, they began in that first assembly to construct shelters. Some made them out of green boughs, others dug caves on mountain sides, and some, in imitation of the nests of swallows and the way they built, made places of refuge out of mud and twigs. Next, by observing the shelters of others and adding new details to their own inceptions, they constructed better and better kinds of huts as time went on. 3. And since they were of an imitative and teachable nature, they would daily point out to each other the results of their building, boasting of the novelties in it, and thus, with their natural gifts sharpened by emulation, their standards improved daily. At first, they set up forked stakes, connected by twigs, and covered these walls with mud. Others made walls of lumps of dried mud, covering them with reeds and leaves to keep out the rain and the heat. Finding that such roofs could not stand the rain during the storms of winter, they built them with peaks daubed with mud, the roof sloping and projecting so as to carry off the rainwater. 4. That houses originated, as I have written above, we can see for ourselves from the buildings that are to this day constructed of like materials by foreign tribes, for instance in Gaul, Spain, Portugal, and Aquitaine, roofed with oak shingles or thatched. Among the Colchians in Pontus, where there are forests in plenty, they lay down entire trees flat on the ground to the right and the left, leaving between them a space to suit the length of the trees, and then place above these another pair of trees, resting on the ends of the former and at right angles with them. These four trees enclose the space for the dwelling. Then upon these they place sticks of timber, one after the other on the four sides, crossing each other at the angles, and so proceeding with their walls of trees laid perpendicularly above the lowest, they build up high towers. The interstices which are left on account of the thickness of the building material are stopped up with chips and mud. As for the roofs, by cutting away the ends of the crossbeams and making them converge gradually as they lay them across, they bring them up to the top from the four sides in the shape of a pyramid. They cover it with leaves and mud, and thus construct the roofs of their towers in a rude form of the tortoise style. 5. On the other hand, the Phrygians, who live in an open country, have no forests and consequently lack timber. They therefore select a natural hillock, run a trench through the middle of it, dig passages, and extend the interior space as widely as the site admits. Over it they build a pyramidal roof of logs fastened together, and this they cover with reeds and brushwood, heaping up very high mounds of earth above their dwellings. Thus their fashion in houses makes their winters very warm and their summers very cool. Some construct hovels with roofs of rushes from the swamps. Among other nations also, in some places, there are huts of the same or similar method of construction. Likewise, at Marseille we can see roofs without tiles, made of earth, mixed with straw. In Athens, on the Areopagus, there is to this day a relic of antiquity with a mud roof. The hut of Romulus on the Capitol is a significant reminder of the fashions of old times, and likewise the thatched roofs of temples or the citadel. 6. From such specimens we can draw our inferences with regard to the devices used in the buildings of antiquity, and conclude that they were similar. Furthermore, as men made progress by becoming daily more expert in building, and as their ingenuity was increased by their dexterity, so that from habit they attained to considerable skill, their intelligence was enlarged by their industry, until the more proficient adopted the trade of carpenters. From these early beginnings, and from the fact that nature had not only endowed the human race with senses like the rest of the animals, but had also equipped their minds with the powers of thought and understanding, thus putting all other animals under their sway, they next gradually advanced from the construction of buildings to the other arts and sciences, and so passed from a rude and barbarous mode of life to civilization and refinement. 7. Then, taking courage and looking forward from the standpoint of higher ideas, born of the multiplication of the arts, they gave up huts and began to build houses with foundations, having brick or stone walls, roofs of timber and tiles. Next, observation and application led them from fluctuating and indefinite conceptions to definite rules of symmetry. Perceiving that nature had been lavish in the bestowal of timber and bountiful in stores of building material, they treated this like careful nurses, and thus developing the refinements of life, embellished them with luxuries. Therefore I shall now treat, to the best of my ability, of the things which are suitable to be used in buildings, showing their qualities and their excellences. 8. Some persons, however, may find fault with the position of this book, thinking it should have been placed first. I will therefore explain the matter, lest it be thought that I have made a mistake. Being engaged in writing a complete treatise on architecture, I reserved to set forth in the first book the branches of learning and studies of which it consists, to define its departments, and to show of what it is composed. Hence I have therefore declared what the qualities of an architect should be. In the first book, therefore, I have spoken of the function of the art, but in this I shall discuss the use of the building materials which nature provides. For this book does not show of what architecture is composed, but treats of the origin of the building art, how it was fostered, and how it made progress step by step until it reached its present perfection. 9. This book is, therefore, in its proper order and place. I will now return to my subject, and with regard to the materials suited to the construction of buildings, will consider their natural formation, and in what proportion their elementary constituents were combined, making it all clear and not obscure to my readers, for there is no kind of material, no body, and no thing that can be produced or conceived of which is not made up of elementary particles, and nature does not admit of a truthful exploration in accordance with the doctrines of the physicists without an accurate demonstration of the primary causes of things, showing how and why they are as they are. Chapter 2. On the primordial substance according to the physicists. 1. First of all, Thales thought that water was the primordial substance of all things. Heraclitus of Ephesus, surnamed by the Greeks on account of the obscurity of his writings, thought that it was fire. Democritus and his follower Epicurus thought that it was the atoms termed by our writers bodies that cannot be cut up, or by some, indivisibles. The school of the Pythagoreans added air and the earthy to the water and fire. Hence, although Democritus did not in a strict sense name them, but spoke only of indivisible bodies, yet he seems to have meant these same elements, because when taken by themselves they cannot be harmed, nor are they susceptible to dissolution, nor can they be cut up into parts, but throughout time eternal they forever retain an infinite solidity. 2. All things, therefore, appear to be made up and produced by the coming together of these elements, so that they have been distributed by nature among infinite number of kinds of things. Hence I have believed it right to treat of the diversity and practical peculiarities of these things, as well as of the qualities which they exhibit in buildings, so that persons who are intending to build may understand them, and so make no mistake, but may gather materials which are suitable to use in their buildings. End of Book 2, Chapter 2.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.